Well, it's already January 24th. It feels like it was only Christmas yesterday. But we're nearly two-thirds of the way through the winter. I'm telling myself that to keep myself in good form. Welcome to Monday's Richie Allen Show. How are you?
It's the BBG, not the BBC. This is your Richie Allen Show, live from the magnificent city of Salford.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
This hour, I welcome back Anna de Buisseret to the program. She is an employment lawyer and a retired army officer. She's an expert in employment law and many other things too. So much to get into with Anna. I don't know where to start, to be honest. Don't miss her. She'll be with me in about 25 minutes' time. Later on in the programme, my old pal Jamie Ike will join us live from Derby. It's been a long time since Jamie was on this programme, going back a couple of years, even further back. Lovely to chat with him. It will be in hour two. That's Monday's programme. It is live, of course, meaning you can interact with me through my website, richieallen.co.uk. Leave a comment. The menu bar comment live, leave a comment and I'll read them out as we go. Can't say fairer than that. Yeah, I'm all right myself, but last week I was in pretty rough shape. No, I'm all right. It's good. It's good to be sat behind this desk chatting with you today. How was your weekend? All right? Peachy? Good? Yeah, mine was good. Did the Sunday Melodies yesterday, enjoyed that, and then just relaxed for the afternoon. Read a bit of my John Grisham book, and then watched a bit of footy, and then went to bed early. I'm an old man. I feel like an old man. A couple of bits of news that I know will interest you. The founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, has won the right to ask the UK Supreme Court to block his extradition to the United States. His supporters are delighted about that, understandably. The High Court ruled today that he did indeed have an arguable point of law that Supreme Court justices may want to consider. So, yeah, he can petition the UK's highest court for a hearing. For the time being, then, he won't be extradited from the UK to the United States. Of course, he should not be extradited for publishing the documents that he did over the years that embarrassed the United States government. But I don't think I need to tell you that. You know that without me telling you. We'll have to watch this one, see how it goes. Boris Johnson has warned Russia that if it invades Ukraine, if she invades Ukraine, I should say, it'll be disastrous. It would be disastrous. Johnson said, quote, painful, violent and bloody business, end quote. Now, I, dear listener, for what it's worth, I don't believe that Russia will invade Ukraine. I don't know how much store or stock you should put in my predictions. I don't believe it's going to happen. The Russian government and the Russian leader, well, they have a legitimate gripe against NATO and NATO expansion. Russia is in the right here, in my opinion, but I don't see it invading Ukraine. At least I hope it won't. NATO says, we've got forces on standby. Of course, NATO has surrounded Russia, reneging on a promise made at the end of the Cold War when NATO said, well, we won't push any further east than Germany. But they were lying. Russia doesn't like it. Why would Russia? We will, of course, watch that closely. It's very important that. Might sound like not done too much on it in recent days. Just watch it and see what happens. So the NHS mandate then, talked about this yesterday on the Sunday thing. The mandate that says if NHS patient-facing staff are not jabbed by April, they will lose their jobs. Meaning, if you haven't had a jab and you do work in such a role within the NHS, you need to have jab number one by February 3rd, which isn't far away now. It's about a week and a half away. However, the Sunday Telegraph published an article yesterday saying that it had heard, it believed, that the mandate might be pushed back, kicked down the road, giving a reprieve to the unjabbed staff. Now, the Education Secretary, Nadeem Zahawi, Conservative MP, was on Talk Radio's Julia Hartley Brewer programme today. And of course, the question came up. You'll hear Brewer first.
Lots of reports over the weekend that this was a policy that, you know, the Royal College of Nurses, the British Medical Association, the Royal College of GPs all oppose, say this is crazy. We're going to lose, you know, tens of thousands of valuable staff, ICU consultants like Dr. Steve James, who we're going to talk to again later in the show, you know, hospital porters, and we can't afford to lose these people. Is it true that this policy is going to be paused?
He doesn't answer the question now.
Well, I think if you're looking after the most vulnerable people who are coming into hospital, you have a duty of care to make sure that you are protected, as well as, of course, protecting them against infection.
But lots of these people have already had COVID. They were on the front line. We were clapping for them a couple of years ago.
And we continue to clap for them. And over 9 in 10 of the 1.2 million full-time equivalents who work in the NHS have already had their vaccine since the announcement of the mandatory vaccination. I think initially it was about 100,000 left to get their vaccine, and it's now down to 70,000. So people are coming forward. And by the way, there's precedent for this, because if you're a surgeon, for example, you know, you can't practice surgery unless you are vaccinated against hepatitis.
This is a wonderful bit of waffling. Brewer, I don't know if Brewer, I know she has a producer. I don't understand why somebody producing Brewer didn't shout in her little earpiece, ask him, are they kicking it down the road, Julia? He hasn't answered that.
So I think people have a duty of care when you're looking after the most vulnerable to make sure that when they come into hospital, they don't, you know, are exposed to an infection of COVID.
But people can still be exposed to an infection from COVID. As you know, I'm just recovering from COVID right now. I'm double jabbed. There's a kissed Karma, treble jabbed. He had COVID and was isolating for some time. You know perfectly well as I do that you can still very easily catch COVID, certainly Omicron, and you can pass it on to other people, even if you've been double jabbed. So that doesn't resolve the issue. And indeed, many of the staff right now who are not jabbed, who have had COVID in the past, have been busy working, covering the shifts in the NHS for staff who have been treble jabbed, who are off with COVID right now.
Very, very shrill there. Good point, though. Imagine that. Staff are covering for staff who are home with COVID, even though they were triple jabbed. Of course, they've not got COVID. They returned a positive test. Doesn't mean they're sick, but anywho. Again, she's not taking them back to the original question. Are you going to announce a moratorium on mandating the jab for NHS staff?
Well, I can tell you that, you know, both as the vaccine deployment minister at the time, talking to the NHS, and, you know, as I say, I think we're at 94% of NHS staff, frontline staff, vaccinated, and that's a really an excellent.
Why not be happy with that?
Excellent, you know, number, but we can build on that further. Why? Because it's important. Because I think people have a duty of care for the most vulnerable. 90% of those in ICU have not been vaccinated.
Yeah, she doesn't ask him for any proof or any evidence of that statement. That 90% of people in ICUs at the moment are in fact unvaccinated. She could have said, if she was any good, now of course she's not great, right? She could have said, well, what about your government's acknowledgement last week that 70% of people in hospital who tested positive for COVID are in fact in hospital for something else entirely? She could have said that, but she didn't. She's not very good. She's not as good as the BBG. It's as simple as that, he says. She's doing a lot better. Let's be honest about it. Let's show a bit of humility there, Baldy. Fair enough. Okie dokie. The journalist Yasmin Alibe Brown was on Jeremy Vine's Channel 5 programme today. She's triple jabbed, is Yasmin Alibe Brown. And she'll probably have jabs number 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 2, 11 and 12. Presumably. Probably, I said. I don't know. But she will not accept medical treatment from a dirt, rotten, stinking, unjabbed NHS person.
It's good to give them more time. But I really think that unless there are medical reasons why certain members of staff cannot be jabbed, I think when you're working in the NHS and care homes, you really should get jabbed. And I think this is the way I would look at it. Those who haven't had jabs but could have jabs need to have a badge saying unjabbed.
Really?
Yeah, and I would not let them treat me.
I wouldn't let them treat me. If you haven't had a jab, you should have to wear a badge that denotes you as an unjabbed person. Unjabbed. I'm unjabbed and I'm proud. She's a bit mad. Let's hear more.
So you would have them walk around hospitals wearing a badge?
Because if you've made a decision and you're coming out on these demos, then you must be brave enough to say, I'm not prepared to have the jab, and a patient has the right to say, then I will not be seen by you.
What about that?
I think that's...
And this is Lowry Turner.
I think that's controversial. I've changed my mind, but in the other direction, actually, because initially I thought, you know what, we're supposed to be all in this together. How incredibly selfish of a healthcare worker to put other people at risk by not being jabbed. But we now know, for example, with Omicron, that two jabs of the AstraZeneca doesn't provide that much protection. So at the moment, being jabbed is two jabs,
well,
not
two jabs
boosted.
Plus booster provides a lot of protection.
Yes, but at the moment, that's not what they're demanding. Sure. They're just demanding two jabs. So actually, it's not that effective. Yes, I'm triple jabbed, or my kids are jabbed, but we are in a crisis here. And if those, and I regard them as selfish, because all they're saying is, we want more time to see whether the jab's safe. So the rest of us, all of us, are the guinea pigs, while they decide in some future moment, oh, well, it is, since you've all had it, now I'll have it.
Oh, yeah, they're looking at us to see.
Are you hearing this?
See if we keel over.
Yes, exactly.
And then they'll say, oh, well, we'll have it. Jeremy's
off. But I think we have...
This is so beautiful, this. You've got to hear this again. This is astonishingly wonderful.
We want more time to see whether the jab's safe. So the rest of us, all of us, are the guinea pigs, while they decide...
That's because you chose to be a guinea pig, you dizzy bint. That was your choice, you daft fucking cow. You decided to stick an untested, untried cocktail of pus, shit and God knows what else into your arm. And now you're giving out because the rest of us were, well, a little bit brighter than you, Lowry Turner. And you're kicking off because we might wait to see if you keel over before deciding whether or not to have it. This woman is batshit crazy.
Some future moment. Oh, well, it is. Since you've all had it, now I'll have it.
Oh, yeah, they're looking at us to see if we keel over.
Yes, exactly.
And then they'll say, oh, well, we'll have it. Jeremy's all right.
But what's wrong with that?
I think we have to staff our hospitals. We have to staff our care homes. So I think we have to say a year's gap.
But what about the Yasmin's cocktail?
A year's gap. So basically, Lowry Turner says that we should have a year between now and mandating the jab, we should leave a year's grace. Oh, I'll tell you what, that was fabulous, that bit of audio.
But we are in a crisis here, and if those, and I regard them as selfish, because all they're saying is, we want more time to see whether the jab's safe. So the rest
We want more time to see if the jab's safe. Selfish bastards.
All of us are the guinea pigs, while they decide in some future moment, oh, well, it is, since you've all had it, now I'll have it.
She's just beautifully described why the great majority of people who haven't had the jab actually haven't had the jab. Because you are a daft bint, you know, taking a medicine manufactured by companies that were indemnified against being prosecuted should that medicine begin to kill people. And it has killed lots of people. How dare people, how dare they wait and see if the jab starts killing people while we are guinea pigs? But nobody put a gun to your head and said you have to have this jab. Here's a bit more of that.
I'm nervous about that because I think that is potentially discriminatory. Because somebody could say, well, I can't have the jab because I have whatever XYZ condition.
That's different.
Well, you're still unjabbed, so you still have to wear a badge.
But you have a different badge saying, you know, I've got a reason.
Yeah. Yasmin Alibi-Brown says, let's have one badge for the unjabbed that says unjabbed, and another badge for the unjabbed, but only unjabbed because they have a medical condition. These people are batshit crazy, aren't they?
Well, then you've got multiple badges.
I think it's... multiple badges. I, as a patient, am not prepared to be treated by anybody...
She went on to reiterate that as a patient, she wouldn't be treated by anyone who hasn't had the jab. Nutters, these people, all of them. It's 14 minutes past the hour. Oh, you gotta love it. Do you know who David Nabarro is? He's the World Health Organization's special envoy on COVID-19. His job, and his only job, is to do the media 3, 4, 5 times a week to say that this is not over, nowhere near over. We're only halfway there. We've got variants to come. It's a deadly virus. And so on, so on, so on, so on. Don't be getting excited. This is not over. No, we should keep the restrictions. He's a bit mad, this guy, David Nabarro. Here he is with Kay Burley, Sky's own Ginger Ninja.
The end is in sight.
But
how long is it going to take to get there? And what sort of difficulties will we face on the way? Those are the questions that none of us can answer, because this virus continues to give us challenges and surprises. So I do want everybody who's watching this morning to your great program to do one thing, and that is to go on treating this virus with respect. It's not changed. It's absolutely not suddenly become a soft thing. It is
now it's not become a soft thing, dear listener, okay? Get that through your thick skull. It's not just become soft.
Still very serious.
Serious it is.
And so for me, if the end is in sight, that's good news. But it's as though we're just passing the halfway mark on a marathon, and we can see that, yes, there is an end and the fast runners are getting through ahead of us, but we've still got a long, long way to trudge, and it's going to be tough.
Did he say we can see an end and the fast, fast runners are getting ahead of us, but it's going to be a trudge? Kay?
As far as our own health secretary is concerned, Sajid Javid says that we need to treat COVID like we treat the flu. Do you agree?
Oh, well, I mean, again, I keep wondering what the people who make these amazing predictions know that I and my colleagues in the World Health Organization don't know.
Well, they know how to count to 10 without taking their penis out. Or is that count to 11? Yeah, don't I look the effing asshole now.
You see, what people are seeing from around the world and reporting to the WHO is this is still a very, very dangerous virus, especially for people who've not been vaccinated who've not been exposed to it before. It also can mutate and form variants, and we've seen several, but we know there are more not far away. So quite honestly, we are not saying that this should be considered to be like flu or indeed like anything else. It's a new virus, and we must go on treating it as though it is full of surprises, very nasty and rather cunning.
Full of surprises, very nasty and rather cunning. David Navarro there, yeah. He could support Liverpool, David Navarro. They could be 5-0 up with 5 minutes to go. 5-0 up against, I don't know, let's say Salford. Let's say Salford City. 5-0 up at Anfield. And Salford could be down to 9 men. I'm sounding a bit like Jonathan Van Tam now with a football analogy. Liverpool 5-0 up, Salford down to 9 men. It's at Anfield. And you say to Navarro, it's looking good, isn't it? No. Salford are just not going away, you know. This guy's a madman. And it must be wonderful for him and others to do the rounds of the media. It must be so relaxing, knowing full well, whichever presenter it happens to be, none of them are going to call you out on your bullshit. None of them. Wonderful. Wonderful, wonderful. I remember a time when I began in the media when guys like Navarro and politicians feared the media, feared presenters, like the presenter I produced, feared them. Nervous coming on the air, nervous coming into the studio. This guy's having the time of his life. Say whatever he wants, doesn't matter. And Kay will say, yeah. Thanks, David. Let's do it again real soon. Come back on and tell us how deadly the virus is while we're all, I don't know, stretched out on the beaches of Cleethorpes and Bournemouth and Eastbourne, eating ice creams and splashing in rock pools and all of that. You keep coming back on to tell us that we're all going to die. David Navarro, 19 minutes past the hour. You can comment on the programme via my website, richieallen.co.uk. I love reading your comments, so keep them coming in, please. To use that well-worn cliche, keep them coming in. I'll be talking to Anna Debuisere, right soon. Later on in the programme, Jamie Icke will be on with me. Some of you are, well, aghast at the comments of Lowry Turner on the Jeremy Vine show. It's a wonderful, gorgeous little piece of audio, isn't it? Isn't it wonderful? It's so bloody wonderful. I'm going to extract it and use it again and again and again and again and a bloody again. Would you like to hear it again?
But we are in a crisis here. And
yeah.
If those, and I regard them as selfish, because they, all they're saying is we want more time to see whether the jab's safe. So the rest of us, all of us, are the guinea pigs while they decide in some future moment, oh, well, it is, since you've all had it, now I'll have it.
Oh, yeah, so they're looking at us to see if we keel over.
Yes, exactly.
And then they'll say, oh, well, we'll have it. Jeremy's all
right. But I think we have to staff our hospitals. We have.
Yeah, that's right, Jeremy Vine. We're looking at you to see if you keel over. What's wrong with that? You were dumb enough to have it. Although I would imagine certain people in the public eye, I would imagine, I have no proof of this, were given placebos. No proof whatsoever. So don't start now. It's just an opinion, that's all. This is The Clash. It's time for a clampdown. It's the Richie Allen Show, Monday's edition, live from Super Salford. BBG Towers, nice to be with you, nice. Music from The Clash, Clampdown on The Richie Allen Show, 22 and a half minutes past the hour. Let's get an extra few minutes with my first guest. She was on the programme back in November. It was great to meet her then. Let's welcome her back. She is a senior employment lawyer and a retired army officer, and I think has done tremendous work around the legality and the ethics of lockdowns and vaccines and particularly the rights of children. And we're going to be talking about the rights of children, which is prescient, to say the least, with her. But we want to talk about something else first. Let's just welcome back to the programme Anna Dubuisseray. Anna, welcome back. How are you?
Oh, Richie, hello, and hello everyone listening in. Thanks for tuning in. And thank you, Richie, once again for providing me with a platform. Because, you know, I really hope that people can hear the message I'm about to deliver, because it's a very important one. So thank you and bless you.
Not at all. Thank you for coming on. You're doing me a favour and you're doing us a favour. So thanks, Anna. Before we talk about children, let's talk about something that's very interesting. And thanks for texting me just before we came on air, because this was at the back of my mind and I'd forgotten about it. I saw this on Twitter. I saw Full Fact UK and I saw Reuters claiming, and it's funny the way they came out to claim this. They came out and claimed that there are no police investigations into lockdowns or vaccine mandates, not vaccine mandates, but how the vaccines came to be manufactured, how the vaccines came to be rolled out. Reuters saying categorically there is no police investigation into any of this, but you say different, Anna.
Well, do you remember when we were all children and a parent left the room and said, don't take anything from the cookie jar?
Yes.
And inevitably somebody did, or we all did, and the parent came back in the room, and what did the children say?
Didn't do it.
I didn't do it. Nothing to see here. That's exactly what's going on. You know, can I just take a moment? For those of you who don't know me, I'm actually a retired army officer, spent almost 10 years in the British Armed Forces. And one of your fundamental training in warfare is know thine enemy. And don't tell them what you're about to do in terms of military attack. And before you attack, you make sure you've done all your preparation, because we have a saying in the military, prior preparation and planning prevents poor performance. It's known as the P's, and you apply that every time you apply a situation. Now, in addition to my military background, as you know, I'm a lawyer and I'm a litigator. So you don't tell people you're going to sue them, and you don't allege crimes against them or offences against them until you've done your own due diligence, proved the necessary burden of proof. So for civil offences, it just has to be on the balance of probabilities. But for criminal offences, you know, the old adage, beyond reasonable doubt. In other words, the average person, the reasonable person, wouldn't doubt that the crime had in fact been committed. Now, we know the fact that all of these perpetrators have got various people in their pockets. And we, the people, have already conducted the live criminal investigation. We've been conducting it for years. And not only we, the people of the UK, but people globally. And we've been collaborating for years at world expert level. So when lawyers allege genocide, crimes against humanity, biowarfare, etc., it's not because they've sat down one morning over breakfast and just thought it would be a good idea. They've alleged them because teams around the world have done their due diligence, conducted the investigation, and have all the evidence. So by the police denying that this is a live criminal investigation, by whoever's perpetrating this thinking, oh, you know, it'll be years of investigating before anybody's brought to court, And people on the street have said to me, oh, you know, if it's only just starting, it'll take years. And I have a good old laugh, not unkindly, but just a good old bellyache, because, you know, you only tell the enemy you're going to attack them once you've already got everything prepared. So the idea that the police can say this isn't happening, that, you know, there's no crime being committed, that they're not going to investigate, that when they investigate, they'll not find any crimes, is ridiculous. And the fact is that teams around the world are flooding the UK police force with their evidence. So, and these are world experts.
Yeah, so, I can endorse. I do get quite a lot of correspondence from people who tell me they have contacted their local police station and they've reported a crime, and in some cases they say they've gotten a crime number. They might have been fobbed off, but you know, they reported it. So I do believe that. I touched on this with you, I think, briefly last time. Look, you're a big girl, you're obviously ridiculously bright, you're very experienced. How can, with respect to what's happened and what is currently happening, how could anybody trust the judicial process, the system in this country or Ireland or in Germany or in France to do the right thing when this evidence is presented to them?
Well, that's a very good question. But can I just take a step back, because people often confuse the institutions and the people running these institutions. So, for example, our rule of law is incredible, and yet people say the law is an ass. No, it's the people operating the law and those legal systems that are not operating it properly, so they're not fit for purpose. The systems and the structure and the legal framework is actually genius, absolute genius, especially in this UK constitution. The failures we have are these. First of all, the evidence shows that for decades, citizens of this country and indeed other countries are not taught law at school, not even their basic fundamental human rights or the basics of criminal law. They're not taught by their parents because their parents were similarly not taught. Now, that's a failure on the part of the state, because all the international humanitarian laws place a specific duty on each state to ensure that their citizens know the fundamentals of their law. So, was that accidental or was it deliberate, dumbing down? That's the first problem. That means that by the time citizens leave at 18, they are Scooby-Doo clueless, use a London rhyming slang,
yes,
of law. They haven't got a clue. And they're not taught about the Constitution either. So again, they haven't got a clue. Now, how many citizens at 18 sit down and put themselves on the law degree? Only the lawyers, typically, or the ones who do an undergraduate and then go off to do something else. But our statistics show that there are 168,000 lawyers in this country out of 68 million people. So we hope that 168,000 would learn it. However, the evidence from this is that the law schools vary in terms of how they seem to be teaching their lawyers. And again, this has been going on for decades. So I personally give credit to Oxford Brookes University and to Nottingham Trent University, who taught me as an undergraduate and as a postgraduate doing the finals course of the law. Because I was taught, as is right, that you go to the original source of any law. You don't rely on somebody else's interpretation. So, for example, when I look at our laws, I go back to the earliest code of law, which is King Hammurabi's code back in ancient Sumer. And I kid you not, but that's only the man-made laws. That's the earliest record of man-made law I can find. And in our British constitution, we can rely on all kinds of sources of law. But in our constitution, it's God's law that we have to uphold paramount. And when people challenge me on that, I refer them to the Coronation Oath Act 1688 and to our current Queen's Coronation Oath of 2nd June 1953, in which she says very specifically, well, the Archbishop says, will you to the utmost of your power maintain the laws of God, the true profession of the gospel, and the Protestant Reformed religion established by law? And the Queen says she promises to do that. Now, the point about that is that God's laws override man-made laws. And if man's laws conflict with God's laws in this constitution, that's in breach of the Queen's coronation oath. So all of our laws are really enshrined in the Old and New Testament with man-made laws and our customs and our practices. You know, and the man-made laws include common law and statute law, and international treaty law, etc., but they all sit under God's laws.
What part does precedent play in this, Anna? You mentioned that. You said that to look at law, you go back to the source, which fascinated me when you said that. What part does precedent, does legal precedent play in the system then? I read a lot about how a precedent was established by a ruling in a case. It could be any case to do with anything. And then from there on in, it's the precedent that's referred to.
Well, absolutely, because as people don't know, because I've now established most aren't taught about the Constitution, in the UK, we do not have a single document enshrining the entire UK Constitution. We have an unwritten Constitution, which means that we can rely on any laws that apply on the situation, because we can rely on a whole body of laws. Now, as long as those laws are not going against God's laws, and as long as they're not illegal in some way, we can rely on all of them, including the concept of precedent. That was introduced to us, as far as I can tell, please correct me if I'm wrong, someone out there, by the Romans through their Justinian Code, because they brought with them their concept of case law, creating precedent.
Right, yeah.
But we also had, in our common law system, precedent, because, for example, the current Queen's coronation oath has had to be sworn by every monarch who's come to this realm in some form or other, but basically saying the same thing. The first part of the oath says that I will govern, not rule, I will govern the peoples of this realm according to their laws. In fact, I'll read the current oath, and it, you know, it's varied over time, but it basically says the same thing. The Archbishop says to the monarch, will you solemnly promise and swear to govern the people of this kingdom of England and the dominions thereto belonging according to the statutes in Parliament agreed on? So they have to be consented to, right? Not as in statutes in Parliament dictated to the people, but the statutes in Parliament agreed on and the laws and customs of the same. And the Queen says, I solemnly promise so to do. And then the next part of it is, will you to your power cause law and justice in mercy to be executed in all your judgments? And again, the Queen says, I will. So that tripartite oath, the first part saying they have to govern according to our laws, not the King or Queen's laws. The second part saying that any justice and law has to be overseen in mercy. And then the third part saying it has to uphold the laws of God and our religion. That oath has had to be sworn by every monarch who's come to our to be crowned.
But it hasn't. But it hasn't happened. It hasn't materialised. We know that every facet of society is corrupt, it's bent, it's filthy. I could be here all day. You and I could talk for hours about, you know, sending weapons to countries knowing those weapons will be used to kill millions of innocent men, women and children. The things that are done to people in this country, forced adoption. Again, we could be here all day long. None of it materialises. When it trickles down, what happens to the layman, the laywoman, people like me, ultimately, there is no justice. None.
Well, there is, if we ensure there is.
You know, how do you do that?
We have all created the society we are currently living in. We are all individually responsible and liable for our actions, our omissions. And if by our omissions we've allowed corruption to sweep over and take over and destroy our constitution, it's happened on our watch. We're to blame. And so I tell people that, because we are all individually liable under the rule of law, and we each have a duty to uphold it. So by people leaving school at 18 and not being taught law and then not teaching themselves, they're failing in their fundamental duty to the coronation oath, to the constitution, to their fellow citizens. And people seem to walk around society thinking they have a choice. They think it's discretionary. They think it's optional. You ask most people what duty they have to their fellow citizen, and they'd look at you like you're nuts.
Yeah, we've been conditioned, though, haven't we? We've been conditioned to almost to separate ourselves from the community, from our neighbours. Selfish individualism is something a friend of mine who's a socialist, who keeps telling me all the time, he despises it. Everywhere he looks, he sees selfish individualism. We've kind of been conditioned to be like that, haven't we?
Well, again, that's a bit of a victim mode, though, isn't it? With respect,
it could be. It could be argued, fair enough.
What citizen, I challenge any citizen to say that they don't know inside their heart that they shouldn't go around killing people, they shouldn't steal, they shouldn't cheat on their spouse, etc. Yes. In other words, the Ten Commandments. That's in our bones. It's in our blood. You speak to people across the world, and ask them for their basic value set, even if they don't believe in a higher spiritual being, they will still tell you it's wrong to go around killing people. So, you know, these commandments are enshrined in us. And so for people to get into this victim mentality of, oh, nobody told me I was breaking the law,
yeah,
when they've gone around and harmed someone, I don't accept it. If you are a decent person and you genuinely don't want to cause harm in society as you live your everyday life, you will jolly well make sure you know the fundamentals of law. And I'm, to be honest, Richie, I'm on a bit of a rant because I'm disgusted by our society at the moment. I'm disgusted by it. You've got the average person in the street thinking they have the right to go up to another person in the street and demand that that person harms themselves for their benefit. Wear a mask, get a test, yeah, get injected, right? They have no right, no right whatsoever. And let's be clear, because everyone has fundamental bodily and psychiatric integrity. When you approach someone in the street, you have no idea what trauma they're carrying, what insecurities, what vulnerabilities, what disabilities. And these people think they have the right to go up to a stranger, one of their country folk, so probably a distant cousin or even a, you know, an aunt they didn't even know they had, right? They walk up to a stranger and they demand that that person harms themselves for their benefit. It's disgusting, and it's actually criminal because it's assault. It's either physical assault or criminal assault because the person isn't consenting to be harmed.
Coercion.
And we now have a society full of these people.
We have a society full of these people. You'll get no argument from me on anything you said there. I wasn't talking about people harming people and then using the excuse, I didn't know I was breaking the law. I suppose I was referring... Oh, no, 100%. Yeah, but can I just finish my point? I'll be very quick. Let me finish this really quickly. No, I was referring to, you know, people who know this stuff is wrong in terms of, like, they know that people being coerced into having a jab is wrong, no matter where they work. They know that it's wrong to mask up children because it's, they know it's wrong to lock children up at home and warn them that they might kill their granny. But they're but they're indifferent to that. And they don't take any steps themselves as an individual in the community to try and remedy that because they are indifferent. And I said they're, you know, they've been programmed into indifference. And you, I think, quite rightly pulled me up and said that's victim kind of mentality. I think you've got a good point there. But I see lots of people like that. They are totally indifferent to what's going on around them and only concerned about themselves and their own bubble.
Can I set people straight on their legal position?
Yeah,
Indifference is a moral and ethical failing on their part. Where they stand in relation to the law and in relation to statute law is that they are either criminally or civilly breaking the law. Now, ignorance of the law is no defence, and they have a duty to uphold it. It's not a discretion. So their indifference is showing that they think they have a discretion. Their ignorance is condemning them, and their arrogance leads them to not inform themselves because they think they're above the law, but they're not, because no one is above the law. And when I hear people saying we can't sue Pfizer, we can't sue these companies, we can't sue our government, no, that's totally wrong. Nobody is above the law because we're all equal in the eyes of God. And so anyone who claims that they are above the law is breaking the law. And anyone who thinks that they have a duty to not uphold the law or to sit on the sofa all day watching Netflix is in breach of our law. It's not an option. It's not a discretion.
Do you know, can I interject there, Anna? We've got Anna de Buisseret on the line. I'm thrilled she's back on the programme. Massive, big brain. I hope she understands I'm not patronising her. I wouldn't dare.
No, I wouldn't dream of it.
A massive brain on her. And I'm out of my depth here, but I'm swimming against the tide. I'm going to have a go anyway. Look, what you're saying to me sounds to me, correct me if I'm wrong, something that I've always been a bit concerned about. Do you remember last year, Anna? You remember when the gentleman was killed in America when the police officer was kneeling on his neck? I think his name might have been Derek Chauvin. Now, so the Black Lives Matter movement then came into our sphere, into our world, and a lot of people were saying that not being racist is not good enough, or not being, you know, homophobic is not good enough. You've got to be active. You've got to be doing something to try and put an end to things like that. And I feel very uncomfortable with that. I'm not racist. Everybody who is racist, funnily enough, says that. So maybe I shouldn't say that. But I don't have a racist bone in my body. But I get very uncomfortable when people say, oh, well, just saying you're not a racist is not good enough. You somehow kind of have to prove yourself or do something to tackle racism. I say, well, no, I don't, actually. And I think some people might listen to this and they might think, well, what can Jimmy Bloggs or Peggy Murphy do if they're masking children up in school? Peggy might not even have a child. You know, how can we possibly lay the blame at the community for what's going on in the school? Go on, you can shoot me right down. Go ahead.
We absolutely can.
Go on.
We absolutely can. So first point for the record, it was George Floyd who was the...
Oh, God, yeah. Derek Chauvin was the officer. Jesus Christ, excuse me, language.
Derek Chauvin was the officer who was subsequently charged, and quite rightly so.
I'm a Muppet.
Clearly he had, yeah. Well, in terms of your second point, I'm afraid, Richie, you will need to be stand corrected because everyone has a duty to act to prevent harm. In this realm, the fundamental principle of our law is first do no harm. And every single member of this society has a constitutional, moral and ethical duty to act to prevent harm to their fellow country folk. OK, and why anyone would think they didn't, I don't know. And the omitting to act when you know it's happening means that you are either perpetrating it or aiding and abetting or complicit in it, which puts you on the wrong side of the law. So, yes. This is the point I keep saying to people. We all have a duty to act. Everybody in society has. You see children in the playground, three-year-olds, and one of them will march up to one other child who's doing something mean to another one and stop them. And they know that in their hearts, age three. They don't have to be told they have a duty to prevent harm to their fellow child. So for adults to walk around thinking that they don't have to do anything, they're less than a three-year-old.
Well, can I say this on that point? Can I say this? I would be the first person, if I was to witness an assault, to intervene. I'm not the toughest. Well, I would. Of course I would. I'm certainly no tough guy, but I'm not frightened of getting a smack. Of course I would intervene. But I would argue that, you know, isn't it the responsibility of the parents of the children who are being abused in schools, because they are being abused. No doubt about that. I agree with what you've been saying for months and months and months now. But isn't it the responsibility of those children's parents to do something about that before the onus is put on me? What do you think?
It's the responsibility, again, of every citizen in society. So the moment a child can talk and act, a child is responsible for the harm being done to their fellow children, let alone a parent, let alone a teacher. So, for example, when I was 5 or 6 and I saw a child being beaten up, I would report it to the teacher and I would stop the other children from harming that child. I was 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 or 9. Now, at 10, I can go to jail for either watching a friend be killed and not stepping in or by doing it myself.
Is that right?
Because the law says by 10, at the very least, and you have to remember the horrible Jamie Bulger crime, those two perpetrators were 10.
Yeah.
And I sat next to one of the pathologists at the dinner that, because as a lawyer, we meet some of these people involved in these cases clearly. And I turned to him and I said, how are you dealing with this? You know, bearing in mind, for those who don't know, who are listening in, Jamie Bulger was I think he was 2, 2.5-year-old toddler, who was snatched by 2 10-year-olds in a shopping mall, strapped to a train track, brutally tortured and murdered by them. And there was an outcry in our society, quite rightly. And when the law was examining the position, clearly there has to be a line between when you're a child and you can stand by and watch someone being harmed or indeed torture a child and not be held accountable for your actions and omissions. Well, the law says it's 10, by which you can go to jail. If you do it before 10, you'd be assessed by psychiatrists and psychologists for whether or not you're a psychopath or a sociopath, because you're a danger. If you're someone who watches other people being harmed around you and you don't step in, you are a danger. You're a danger to us all.
The
law recognises that.
There are mitigations as well, though. You know, fear is a powerful...
I'm all ears.
Yeah, well, you know, fear is obviously a very powerful thing, isn't it? Like, I have intervened in the past when somebody is being assaulted. I've done it a couple of times. I was a nightclub DJ for years and years. I saw stuff going on at 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, and sometimes I would get involved if I could. But there are others who wouldn't because they're terrified of it, of violence, and terrified of what might happen to them. And that's mitigation, isn't it, I think? fear?
Well, you know, the fact is the law will look at what you've acted and omitted to do in that decision. You are then, on the face of it, prima facie is the term we use on the in the law, prima facie, on the face of it, guilty of acting or omitting to act in that situation. You then, as the defendant, have to plea your mitigation. And in certain defences, such as murder, you know, to say I was scared, you would have to prove that that fear made you immobile, for example, or that you were insane, or that you were suffering from diminished responsibility. There are certain pleas, as a defendant, you are allowed to submit. But those pleas are very, very complicated. And I'll tell you with this, most judges are not mental health experts. So if you submit a plea in defence that you were scared, you're then going to have to produce expert evidence to prove that that fear excused you from taking action. And that level will be extremely high.
Because the
assumption in law is that every person has capacity, mental capacity. Therefore, you know the difference between right or wrong. Therefore, you should know you have a duty to act or prevent harm. So, you know, to plead that you were scared would mean that you didn't have mental capacity. And then you're basically saying that you are insane, which means that when you put in your plea for in mitigation for insanity, if you're found guilty, you'll be locked up in a secure psychiatric institution, not a prison.
I'm saving up, by the way, in case I ever do need legal representation. I'm saving up. I've got a big old wine bottle and I'm putting pound coins in there every day so that I can give it to you if I ever need a solicitor. By the way, I'm aware of the irony of saying I'm not racist and then getting George Floyd's name wrong and calling him by the name of the man that killed him. I'm well aware of that. That will go to my grave. I was floundering.
Can I just read Article 6 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, right? Because you're talking about an incident that happened in America, and this incident could happen everywhere.
Anywhere, yeah.
Because the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 1948, applies to everyone. Article 6, everyone has the right to recognition everywhere as a person before the law. Now, note they say a person. So not a black, or not a anti-vaxxer, or not a nutter, or any other adjective that you give to a human being, a person. So everyone has the right to recognition everywhere as a person before the law. Article 7, all are equal before the law, and all are entitled without discrimination to equal protection of the law. All are entitled to equal protection against any discrimination in violation of this declaration and against any incitement to such discrimination. And I hope all the MSM are listening to this, and the politicians, and all those in society who are inciting hatred at the moment to various groups within society. Yes, the Black Lives Matter movement is critically important because, unfortunately, that part of society has always been victimized and oppressed and hated upon. It's horrific. We should be ashamed of ourselves. But, you know, they're not the only people. We've got 14.1 registered disabled people. I might be incorrect actually saying they're registered, but 14.1 million disabled people in this country. And yet the hate crime towards the disabled community is disgusting. And particularly given that a lot of people who can't take these injections in, who can't wear a mask, and who can't comply with these illegal orders are disabled, and yet they're being hated upon because they cannot comply, because it would harm them even more than someone who fortunately for them is perfectly healthy. And yet these people are now doubly suffering. They're suffering from their disabilities, and at the same time they're living in a society where they're too scared to leave their front door in case Jane Nosey bullies them at the store for not being able to wear a mask. It's disgusting, Richie.
We've got
These people should be ashamed of themselves. Who do they think they are?
Yeah. Oh, and I've seen so many videos online of these incidents. Alan de Buisseret is our guest. We've got 15 minutes. I want to talk about children. We're going to go till 6:05. Anna is a former army officer, 10 years as an army officer, and not practicing right now, but a very experienced lawyer, and has done a lot of good work.
Can I please pick up on that point?
You can.
I'm so sick of explaining this to people. So for the public record, yes, I am a qualified solicitor, a fully qualified solicitor of the Law Society of England and Wales. I was registered at the Law Society in October 1996. You can check that with them and with the Solicitors Regulation Authority. Now, the issue about practicing or non-practicing is a specific term that our regulatory framework provides for the public to distinguish between those lawyers who are, those solicitors rather, who are conducting non-reserved legal activity or reserved legal activity. Now, reserved legal activity is defined in the Legal Services Act 2007 as being certain activities, including litigation, drafting wills, etc. Now, I'm not doing that work. And I'm not doing that work because I don't want to do that work. Not because I can't, not because I've been banned, not because the Law Society or the SRA don't want me to have a practicing certificate, but because I don't want to. So I'm a practicing solicitor in the sense that I'm perfectly entitled to practice law every day. As long as I don't do those reserved legal activities, I do not require a practicing certificate. So the fact that I don't hold one is no, you know, nothing
yeah.
to do with...
And I wasn't implying anything else, to be honest. As you know, I wasn't implying anything else at all.
No.
But thanks for setting it straight, yeah.
The trolls have been and the MSN have been, and it was all over Twitter late last week because 77th Brigade, etc., are all trying to discredit me by telling everyone that I'm not fit to practice.
Which is nonsense, yeah. Well, I know how the MSM operates, and I know yeah. they would put a blunt line, they would put a line like that in an article, knowing that it has implications that are untrue. So thanks for correcting that.
We're launching a defamation claim against them. So that I wrote to some of the journalists today and demanded that they gave me their name and address for service because we're drafting the claim at the moment. It's not on. They're discrediting, yeah. it's not just me, they're discrediting other lawyers in the profession, so they're discrediting the entire legal profession by association. And by discrediting me as a veteran, they're discrediting me as an army officer holding the Queen's Commission and the British Armed Forces. And, you know, that's not on. Who do these journalists are?
They're not journalists, Anna. They're not. I mean, I've worked at every level of it. These people are not journalists. They're propagandists. You think Lord Ho-Ho, really.
Yeah.
You know, we've got 10 minutes, right? 11 minutes. We talked this morning extensively about children and the rights of children and what is happening to children. Unspeakable crimes against children, mental health crimes, psychological torture, I would call it. That's not being melodramatic. And that's where your focus is right now, Annie, you told me earlier.
Yes, well, going back to the duty point, our sacred duty, every man, woman and child living, our sacred duty is to protect the next generation, including those in the unborn, you know, the unborn children in the womb. And so everybody should be off their sofas trying to stop those pregnant women and those toddlers and those children from being injected and tested and masked and harmed. Because they can't stand up for themselves. They can't hire lawyers like me, and most of their parents can't either. So everyone in society should be protecting those most vulnerable members of our society, but also the future of the human race. So I'm astonished that people haven't worked out that sacred duty, and those of us that have are being ridiculed and shamed, etc. And yet what we're doing is trying to protect those people who can't protect themselves. So I agree, the parents need to get on it. And they need to, and lots of them are. There are incredible groups around the country who are on this. But there's also a huge number of our citizens who think that they don't have to do anything. And again, I'm disgusted, to be honest, Richie. I'm sorry I'm ranting today.
You're not. No, you're very...
I've got to the point where I'm just so disgusted.
Very fluid.
Children are dying, being killed in the womb by people in society saying, you pregnant woman should take this shot to protect all of us. And meanwhile, she's suffering a spontaneous miscarriage. She's lost her precious unborn child, never knowing if she can carry a child again because she's been bullied, coerced, lied to, threatened, discriminated against if she does an experiment on her unborn child while she's being forced to wear a mask so she can't breathe properly, so her unborn child can't breathe properly. Right? So let alone the children in school, there's that unborn child in that womb. It makes me weep. I can't sleep at night.
It's unspeakable, yeah. It's horrendous. I've had moments like that in the last 2 years. I have. I won't say I've had many of them. I spend most of my time in a kind of a daze, I absolutely stupefied by what I am seeing and hearing. And I have had my moments, particularly around the kids. We all get emotional around the kids. When I say we all do, sadly maybe we all don't. but some of us do. And yeah, to see, I walked down Liverpool Street the other day and I saw a couple taking their very, very young primary school, primary school aged child to the school on Liverpool Street, the primary school there in Salford. And the child was tiny. So maybe, I don't know, first form, second form. And the child's face was completely covered by a mask. And I thought, Jesus Christ, I thought to myself, you know, what is happening?
Thank you for calling down the power of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I don't mean to blaspheme. I don't mean to blaspheme. No, anyway.
Well, I take it that you're calling down his spiritual power because, frankly, yeah. Thou shalt not kill is a commandment. It's not an option. And those parents are suffocating their child. Now, the ultimate judge of these people is going to be our Heavenly Father. And so whether they think they can get away with this in this lifetime, they won't in eternity. And they're going to have to beg for mercy and forgiveness. And I'm not their judge. None of us are their judge. They're going to be judged. And, you know, parents who are harming their children in that way, having not bothered to do their research about whether they're harming their children, are committing crimes. That is criminal assault against their own child. If their child suffers a disability, that's grievous bodily harm against their own child. If they die, they've murdered their own child. And they are saying, my government told me to do this. The teachers told me. The teachers' union. Whoever in society they've listened to, they've listened to another person telling them to physically assault and psychiatrically assault their own child.
Let me argue That's with you real. Again. Let's have a quick row in the few minutes that we have left. Anna de Buisere is our guest. Look, if they... You see, I hear you, and it kills me to see children being treated like that. And you want to grab the parents and shake them and ask them, do they know what's going on? But most of the parents, they don't have any reason to distrust not just the government, but these scientific experts the government roll out and the media. They're being bombarded from every angle. So they believe this stuff. So by believing it... in my opinion, it absolves them of, I won't say all responsibility, but if it came to the child being permanently harmed, I'm going to give the parents a pass there.
Yeah. Richie, I can't because I'm just Why? Saying with their legal position, because that's their legal position. Look up Section 20, Offences Against the Person Act, Section 23, Section 47, Offences Against the Person Act 1861. That's what the law states. So whether it's their opinion that they think they've got a reasonable excuse or whether you forgive them or not will be a matter for the court and for the jury, because that is crimes that they're committing against their own children. That's just a legal position. It's not my opinion.
Yeah, but you can only commit a crime if you know you are committing a crime, right?
But the problem here is knowledge is imputed, so ignorance of the law is no defence. And the issue is this. I'm a parent. I've had multiple people want to harm my children. They're now, thankfully, in their adulthood. I've kept them alive. They've kept themselves alive. But that's not without multiple people through their lives trying to harm them. Now, do I wait for someone else to tell me whether someone's going to be harming my child? Or do I risk assess the situation for myself, as is my duty? And I do the latter. I don't let anyone tell me whether something is or isn't safe for my child without doing my absolute proper due diligence on the situation, which is how I know about masks, because when this first happened, I knew my own children, would be pressured to take them. So I did an extensive study. I went back to 1897, when masks were first born, through to date, and I did all the studies on all the harms that it would cause my children, and then I presented my children with my own risk assessment. And I'm just a parent, right? I'm not a teacher, a head teacher. I'm not the government. So any parent who says, I didn't know, has not done their own risk assessment for their own child. They've relied on somebody else's risk assessment. That's not parenting.
No, but I'd like to defend. Anna, you just went a little bit muffled there. I don't know if you've got the phone very close to your mouth. Yeah. No, it's okay. I would like to defend those parents. I'd love to do a mock trial with you. I'm not sure I'd beat you, but I'd like to have a go at you. And say, listen, they've been bombarded. Most people have never had any reason to distrust their government. Most people have never fallen foul of the government, however corrupt they might be.
Have they slept through their entire lives?
No, they haven't. No, but maybe they have. And again, we're down to control. We're down to programming that begins at school. You know, trust the people in the white coats with the stethoscopes. These are the people telling them the jabs are okay. These are the people telling them that masks are really good. They don't have any reason to doubt them. I'm going to give you the final word on that. And I'm going to beg you to come back again soon to pick up these issues. And I'd love to get into a discussion with you around hate crime laws and hate speech. And,
yes,
and that,
I'd love to. I'd welcome that. And I'd happily do a mock trial. As I say, what I'm about to say next is not my opinion. My opinion is just one voice in how many billions on the planet. It's not my opinion. This is the law. The law states that they're in breach of it. By masking, testing, injecting their children, they are breaking the law. They are committing criminal assault on their own children. Their children aren't consenting. They can't consent. They aren't giving their informed consent. They're being bullied, lied to, shamed, etc., which, even if they were apparently consenting, means that their consent was unlawful. So these are mass acts of crimes against humanity, genocide and biowarfare. Fact, on the evidence, on the law, and that's not my personal
opinion. I agree with you, 100%.
To be clear. And when people protest, I challenge them. We've just established they weren't taught law at school. What law degree have they had? When have they taught themselves law? So when they protest at me and say, you're talking nonsense, I say to them, well, you've just told me, and I know you don't know the law. So you're just making it up that it's nonsense because you're in denial that you don't want the law to be that way. You want to convince yourself you've done nothing wrong, but that's not what the law says.
Anna, brilliant to have you back on the programme today. Thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Bless you. And I'm sorry, everyone, if I sound so firm, but this is very serious and people have to stop harming other people, particularly our children and particularly our pregnant mothers with their precious unborn children in their womb. Please, everybody, cease and desist from harming everyone else.
Thanks, Anna. Anna de Buisseret, lawyer, senior lawyer and former army officer, 10 years as a UK army officer. Thanks so much to Anna for that. At the time, I do believe, is coming up for 4 minutes past the hour. It's Monday's Richie Allen Show, the 24th of January. As I said at the top of the programme, we're nearly there, are we? Are we? Are we nearly there? Are we nearly through the winter, are we? I don't know. Let's hope we are. It feels like we might be. Don't forget, Jamie Ike next. I'll be reading your comments after this.
The Richie Allen Show features doctors, scientists, academics and researchers
who have been banned by the legacy media.
Support Richie now by making a financial contribution
at richieallen.co.uk.
Lovely, welcome back. Yes, your comments, let me get into some of your comments. The way to write to me or type to me or text to me is to go to richieallen.co.uk at the top of the page on the menu bar, comment live. You do need to have an account, excuse me. Bruce says you can't keep excusing people's behaviour. If they want to watch X Factor and EastEnders all day, so be it. But when shit happens, you can't say it's not their fault. I'm not saying what isn't anyone's fault. But for me, it's a very grey area. I don't agree with Anna, and she's far, far, obviously, better versed than I am on the legalities of these issues. I defer to her expertise. Of course I do. She has the law. She understands it. I don't agree with the law. I don't agree that parents who are sending their children to school are committing child abuse with masks. I don't believe that. That is too simplistic. That is just my opinion. I don't like it. I want, as I said, to shake them by their lapels. Are you crazy? But they are not knowingly abusing their children. So you say it's child abuse. In fact, I agree. It is abuse of a child to stick a mask on a child's face, to tell a child that you could possibly kill your grandparent by giving them a hug. Yes, absolutely. But who's ultimately culpable for it? I've had a conversation many times with my great friend Jean-Ann Crowley. We've talked about this. Most people are not like you and me. We are in the minority. Most people, let's say middle-income people, they've always gotten along. They've always had a job. They've had their house, paying their mortgage. They have their children. Life is pretty mundane, maybe life is exciting. But the state has never crossed their path. The state has never imposed itself upon them. They don't know any better. So when the political class, and remember, it wasn't just the Conservative Party, it was Labour, it was the Lib Dems, it was the Greens, all of them said there is a deadly virus. It's going to kill hundreds of thousands of people. We need to lock down. You need to put your businesses at risk. We need to take the children out of school. We need to terrorise the children. We need to put masks on them. Most people believed it. And if you can prove that they believed it, well, then you can disprove that they have abused their own children. But that's not the same as saying the children haven't been abused. And this is not double speak by me or new speak, to coin the Orwellian, not to coin it, to repeat the Orwellian phrase. They're not abusing their children knowingly, in my opinion. Anna has the law, I defer to it. But I don't believe that things are black and white. They are not black and white. Nothing is. That's one of the things that has depressed me so much over the years about the independent media, that it's seemingly full of people who want to reduce every single issue down to a strand or strands of simple absolutes. Nothing is simple, in my opinion. What is happening to us feels very simple to me and you. Whatever COVID is, if it exists, I know some of you don't believe it does. I operate on the basis that it does. But hey, hey ho, we get on. We still talk, right? We know it's not a pandemic. We know there was never a pandemic. We know that of the 150,000 people they claim to have died of it, we know that the vast majority of them were not killed by a respiratory infection. Tested positive within 28 days of dying. Listed as a COVID death. We know the whole thing stinks. Simple to you and me, but for everybody else it isn't. It's something else entirely. I saw the fear on people's faces. I think I told you back in April or May of 2020 of an extraordinary encounter I had in my local park when the golden retriever, Leia, very, very young then, ran to a chap who was walking his dog on a lead. Our dogs have never been on the lead because they're good, they're trained, and I don't think dogs should be on the lead, but that's another thing entirely. So she runs over, Leia. It's in the spring, it's wet, I don't want her jumping up and down on people. I go to get her, and the guy with the other dog nearly has a fucking heart attack because of my proximity to him. Leapt back as if I'd whipped from under my coat a long sword and was brandishing it at him. But I wasn't. I was just grabbing my dog by her collar to say, come on, Leia, leave people alone. Let's go and do our own thing. The guy jumped back and then told me not to get too close. The guy was absolutely terrified. If that guy puts a mask on his child, that guy is not abusing his child. That guy has been scared witless that there's a disease, a virus, it's airborne. And if you get it, it could kill you and kill the people around you. You might say, Richie, things are different now. Surely now people have had enough time to realise that something is amiss. Yes, you could make that argument. And I listen to it. I listen to all arguments. We have a phone in this week, don't we? You can ring up and you can argue with me on this point. I'll listen to you. Of course I will. And we can bash that one around for a bit, you know, personal responsibility and, you know, child abuse and all of that. We can do all that. This is your Richie Allen Show, live from Salford. The time is exactly 6:10. Jamie Icke is next after this from Dire Straits, Sultans of Swing with you. Yeah, it's a bit of a travesty to cut that one short. Dire Straits and Sultans of Swing on the Richie Allen Show, 6:13. Drive time. Always good to be with you. Thanks for the comments. Raging argument there on the website about whether it's willful abuse or whether it's unknowing abuse. We'll get into that on the phone in, I think, this week. My next guest is an old friend of mine. He's a great, great guy. He has more titles than the former heavyweight champion of the world, Apollo Creed. Remember Apollo Creed, the master of disaster, the king of Sting, the count of Monte Fisto? Well, my next guest, he's done everything. He has managed international speaking tours on behalf of his father. That takes a bit of ability. What else has he done? Well, he's played football. He was on the books of Manchester United at one time. The lucky bastard. He's involved with what I consider to be a brilliant platform at the moment called Iconic. Do check out iconic.com. He was instrumental in setting it up. It is a platform for programs, video programs, television programs with brilliant presenters interviewing excellent people, the people you don't see, of course, on the mainstream media. Lovely to welcome back to the program my old pal Jamie Icke. Good evening, sir. How are you?
I'm very well, mate. How are you?
Not too shabby at all. Not too shabby at all. Of course, since we last spoke on this programme, an awful lot has happened in the world, but an awful lot has happened to you too. Married to the lovely Beth. Children. Children, Jay.
Yeah, absolutely. Two of them. Two under two. That's
that's a podcast on its own, that, isn't it? Being yeah, a father. Yeah. Fantastic, mate.
A few more wrinkles than I had a couple of years ago. Yeah,
yeah, of course, a few more grey hairs, but at least you have hair, so I won't throw stones at that particular glass house. Now, before we talk about, you know, how you're feeling about what's been happening, what it has meant for you and for your family, and obviously how it motivates you with the children, mentioning at the top of the programme that you were coming on, needless to say, I was bombarded with people asking, is David Icke planning to take to the road again, to the theatres, on the highways and byways, and deliver those unique speaking events? Well, Jay, you're the man.
I'm not anymore, actually.
Are you not?
But I'm not, no. Gareth has taken over from me.
Gaz is doing it.
And all that side of stuff. Iconic has become much bigger, much quicker than I thought it would, so that has to take full attention at the moment, because that's a lot of work on its own. In terms of that, though, I think all I'd say is it would depend on, you know, restrictions. I mean, I know for a fact that he would never want to, and I'm sure you'd be the same, ever want to do a show where a theatre demanded any proof of anything to enter.
Yes.
Expected anybody to wear masks or anything like that, or expected any form of social distancing. I'm sure that would be a no, an absolute no. But I'm sure he'd love to. I mean, he's 70 in a couple of months. So I'm sure he'd want to get out on a tour while he still can, absolutely. But yeah, I'm not the person to speak to.
You're not the person to ask. Next time I speak to Gaz, I'll ask him. But yeah, you can imagine I had many of those messages during the show after I mentioned that you were coming on. 70 in April, isn't it?
It is April the 29th.
In April, yeah, that's right, 70. Right, we, the great David Icke, go to davidicke.com, folks, for more on what David is doing. And maybe you can harass Gareth on Twitter about speaking events. But yeah, obviously, Jay, of course it is obviously dependent on what venues do, what venues don't do, with regard masking and all of that. So that's a good point. So Iconic then has been going, what, about 18 months, has it, or 2 years or thereabouts, or just under that?
Yeah, 5th of November 2019 we launched, and I didn't really know what to expect. It was very much a dip the toe in and see what happens. And then within, 4 months, the world blew up, and it became a lot bigger, a lot quicker, because people were striving for alternative information. I'm sure, obviously, you've seen a massive bump in listeners since March 2020. Yeah. People want to see the other side. So that's kind of taken over my life, really. But I mean, the concept, I think we'd probably both agree that the media are so vacuous and they're so self-obsessed and, you know, self-indulgent that they don't actually care what people think. And I think the media, for me, are who should be held responsible for a lot of the things that we see in the world, because you're always going to have corruption, you're always going to have nasty people, but if the media did their jobs, they'd be exposed before they got to these positions of power. And if they did get to those positions, they wouldn't be there very long, because they'd be exposed. And I always felt that the media was a great way for us to try and counteract that and get information out there that you're not going to see and you're not going to hear, And clearly it's working because, you know, the censorship and the aggression towards the alternative media wouldn't be happening unless they were scared of their influence. And as we're seeing, you know, with stories coming out about things like the BBC, that they're struggling. You know, how many online media channels that, you know, you'd think of as the big mainstream media, like, you know, The Guardian and people like that, they're asking for donations.
That's right.
Because, you know, they're struggling because people aren't buying it anymore. They're looking for alternative sources. And I think that you know, what there wasn't in this country, and certainly, you know, certainly this country, possibly a little bit in America with the likes of InfoWars, is there wasn't an alternative media industry in a sense where there wasn't a channel that was producing content on a range of subjects. There's great shows, obviously yourself being one, but there wasn't that, you know, there wasn't people doing longer form stuff like films and series, and also shorter form stuff like news and current affairs. So I felt there was a real need for that, and also a need for a channel, something that we owned as an alternative media, if you like, that wasn't reliant on Facebook or Instagram or YouTube. You know, so many people, as you well know, that put lives into YouTube channels just had them deleted overnight, yourself being one.
Yeah.
And they lost, you know, people have lost archives of videos, and some people with hundreds of thousands, if not millions of subscribers and things like that. And I felt like if we can try and create something that kind of takes as many aces off of them as we can, and we have control of, and people can't just come in and go, I'm switching you off, then that was a good starting point. And yeah, it's done pretty well so far in terms of interest.
It's terrific. I love production values. It's my thing. I get sexually aroused, Jay, when I look at a show and it looks beautiful and it sounds great. It's all that matters to me. You could be talking about anything as long as it looks and feels good. And what you've done there is you've produced the channel. It's like Netflix, really, for independent media. That's all I can say about iconic.com. I recommend people check it out if you haven't before. The choice there, as you said earlier on, about the different subjects, topics and stuff, and it's just, it's beautifully put together. I mean, you've obviously selected very smart people who know what they're doing and put them together. It shows when you're watching the programmes. It really does.
Yeah, I mean, it started really small. It started with obviously myself, Gareth, and Richard Willett, who I believe you know as well,
yeah.
And a lady called Gina, who used to work with me when I ran stuff for my dad. And yeah, it started the four of us, and we've now got 21 full-time employees. We've got some amazing people across the board. You know, we've got some amazing filmmakers. Wonderful lady called Christiana, who's Dutch and absolutely incredible filmmaker, who's very experienced. Combine that with, you know, some really young and ambitious young filmmakers that are in their early 20s that are producing some great stuff. With Gemma Cooper, the former BBC producer, she's a full-time producer on the Right Now show with Gareth now. I think she was on your show a few months ago to tell her story.
Great lady, yeah.
We've got another guy we've hired from, direct from the BBC in Cambridge, who's running the gallery. We've got a former digital producer who was at ITV for a number of years, worked on some big shows there. So that's what I meant in the first answer to do with alternative media industry, is that there's now somewhere for these really, really talented people that don't want to work for that side, if you like. There's somewhere for them to come and to be able to use their talents, but use them for the good side, the right side, the side that are trying to get information out to people. So that's where it's quite unique.
And be excited. I got that when you said it first time. I should have said, I got that. That's brilliant. And be excited by the fact that they can produce content that mirrors those production values from where they came from. That's hugely important, Jay. You know, there are people could leave mainstream media companies disillusioned because they can't tell the truth. Before Iconic, where are you going to go where you can do that sort of work and do it and make it look, you know, all singing and dancing? That's what you've done, as you just said there. Brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's that's I think what was missing was the because obviously with television being all about pictures and images and it's appeals to two senses. I think if it doesn't look right, then it doesn't look as credible. And I think, you know, somebody sat in a BBC studio with a smart tie, reading autocue seamlessly, it looks like they know what they're doing. Whereas somebody filming on a webcam or something like that with you know, mess in the background behind them, they might be talking a lot more sense. But to somebody that is just walking down the street that's looking at this information for the first time, one's going to appear more credible than the other. And I think that's what was missing. I remember a conversation we had years ago, Richie, and you were saying it's not too difficult to sound as good as the mainstream, but it's incredibly difficult to look as good.
Yes, yes, absolutely, yeah.
And I think that's where that was, there wasn't that in the alternative media, particularly in the UK. Although ironically, and this is a massive compliment to yourself, I actually think, just from my limited experience of the media world, I think you have to be a much better radio presenter to be good than you have to be a TV presenter to be good, because you're only appearing to one sense, aren't you? If what you're saying is not engaging to people, they're not interested. Whereas, you know, you watch, take something like Sky Sports News, there's so much going on that screen, you're not really looking at the presenters. So if they're not that good, you're probably not going to notice.
Yeah, I think your dad always said that, I think, back in the day.
Yeah, I also think radio is a really good way, because you're not distracted, are you? You know, you're listening, you're intently listening to that, to that words. But yeah, the reason we went for the television side was that visuals are a very, very good way to communicate topics that people might not have thought about before. If you can't comprehend or imagine something, but you can be shown it, then that can help communicate that. And, you know, we've got a really, really great team of people, and we were really lucky as well to meet a really good team of graphic designers and CGI guys who are very, very talented, that have been able to help us, particularly with some of the stuff my dad's done, particularly the nature of reality side of stuff, help him with some really good CGI graphics to explain the concepts that he's trying to get across. You know, things like that are priceless, really.
Yes, something he wouldn't have had access to before. He had, obviously, Neil and his amazing illustrations. Fabulous, he wouldn't take anything away from that. But he never had anybody that could bring it to life the way Pixar Studios could back in the day, or something else. That's fascinating, Jamie. We might come back to that in a few moments. Jamie Icke is our guest. Iconic.com, IconiC.com. Relatively new platform, late 2019. It is excellent. He's not paying me to say that. And I'm not trying to curry favour with him. It is brilliant. I really like it. Let's talk about A Good Death, which you co-directed.
Yes.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
It's the best documentary I've seen in years. It's horrible. And it's brilliant. It's compelling. Tell us a bit about it, Jay.
Yeah, so the story first came around through Jackie Devoy, journalist Jackie Devoy, is obviously a mutual friend. She first contacted about this story to do with DNARs and DNRs being put on people in care homes. And she wanted to run that story in the mainstream, and no one picked it up. And then she continued to look at it further, and I know that her father is sadly no longer with us relatively recently. He was in that hospital, so she was seeing a lot of this stuff firsthand. And then she was getting contacted time and time again by people to do with the use of a drug called midazolam, which if you do any research into it, then it's only got one outcome, and that is death, basically, slowly and very painfully. And it was actually used in the lethal injection in America at one time and got removed because it was considered too inhumane because of how the effects on that last period of life were. And there's no explanation for why this is being used in care homes and in hospitals across the country. It's just a new protocol, and all of the families that we had in this documentary, some of which had, you know, midazolam and diamorphine written on the charts to show that they were given it, they were all told by the doctors and nurses and those in hospital that this was there to help their loved ones. Many of these loved ones went into hospital with very minor things, you know, very few were literally at death's door, and they were given these drugs and died shortly afterwards, within a number of days or a week or so. And during that time, you know, families were not allowed to see their loved ones. They were dictated to by doctors. They were told that this was happening, that was happening, and it wasn't. They were constantly passed around from doctor to doctor, so you had no sort of consistent one person that you were dealing with, that you built up a relationship or a rapport with. And all the stories were absolutely heartbreaking. I remember one in particular, a lovely gentleman called Ravi. Him and his wife were NHS nurses and had been for 20-odd years, and she had an adverse reaction to the AstraZeneca vaccine, went in and was put on end-of-life care and died shortly afterwards.
Yeah.
You know, we met a lovely gentleman in Liverpool called Lee, whose dad was a really famous blues musician in Liverpool, really well known and loved. And he went in again and was given midazolam and morphine and never woke up. So there's no justification for this. And there's obviously been a few articles, BBC and The Times did a bit of hit piece on me and Jackie and the film.
Yeah.
And at no point do they discuss what they discuss midazolam.
No, that's incredible, isn't it? Yeah.
There's no justification for why this drug is used. It's a drug that I believe is used at some points in surgery, but only with an antidote. And I think it's something to do with when you're having heart surgery, it kind of slows things down, which allows that to be easier. But then there's an antidote to it. So it should never be given without the other. And it's being given to people regardless of their size, age and weight, 2.5 milligrams as soon as they go in. And, you know, for someone like me or you, we might not, you know, that might be okay. But a 7-stone old lady, that'd kill.
These are people that weren't terminally ill. These are people who should have been expected to leave hospital at some stage, but didn't.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just the rebadging of the Liverpool care pathway that was supposedly scrapped, which was a very inhumane end-of-life care scheme that got so much, you know, backlash that they were forced to officially scrap it. But that's all this is. And that's, you know, in my opinion, the research that we've done, that's what the first wave of COVID deaths was. It was the excessive use of midazolam in care homes and in hospitals, which led to that spike in March, April 2020. And it's still being used now. You know, there's the paper trail exists to show that Matt Hancock and the Department of Health ordered a massive dose of midazolam from a drugs company in France. That's now ordered a 2.5-year supply. That went all by the end of 2020. They've just ordered some more. So this is still going on now. And I think that's what's so scary about the film. It's not like it's sort of looking back. This happened last year. Let's make sure this never happens again. It's a warning. It's happening now. So to people that have loved ones in care homes or loved ones in hospitals, you've got to absolutely watch them like a hawk. And you'd think it'd be slightly easier now because the kind of accessibility to go and see them is a little bit more than it was, you know, 18 months ago. But, you know, you've got to watch them like a hawk. You know, ask them to see if they got a DNR on them. Are they being given midazolam? You've got to really watch these people because, unfortunately, and this is one of the things the press tried to do with the stories, was paint it that we were having a go at the heroes. You know, the NHS are the heroes of this, and we were having a go at them. We were saying that NHS nurses and doctors were killing people. No, we're saying that they're following protocols, and the protocols are not set by them, but they're following them.
Well said. And they're determined by somebody else.
Yeah, they are following them by somebody else. Yeah. And there was I remember one quote in the film from Lee, about his dad, was that when he asked the doctor, he said, look, everything that's done in here is protocol. It's decided from above. A doctor said that to him when he asked him why he was being given certain drugs. So I'm not having a go at the heroes, no, as you call them. I'm saying they're being asked to do this. They're choosing to do it. You know, if somebody told me to go and shoot someone in the head, I would say no. But they're just following those rules. And, you know, they may well think there's nothing wrong in what they're doing, but I struggle to see that personally because, you know, you administer this stuff enough times, you're going to start to see what
happens.
People want to
kill people. You of course, know that your father has written extensively about some horrendous things over the years. He's written about pedophilia groups and rings of pedophiles, horrible stuff. And you would have read those books. You would have been involved in the publication of them, of course, working with davidicke.com. But still, I bet during the making of A Good Death, folks do see it if you haven't seen it. I bet you were horrified at times, were you, by some of the things you heard?
It was incredibly tough. It was really tough. Particularly the interview with Lee in Liverpool, because that was about 5 days after his dad had died. It was so raw. But it was horrible. It was really tough to listen to these stories. And I just remember being sat there thinking, well, both my parents are of the age, older actually, by a good few years at times, than some of the people being described. And you're thinking, you know, what if they go into hospital? What if they need this? What if they need that? And this is what's happening to people. And it was really scary. It was really scary because I think, you know, when you've been involved in the alternative media for a long time, you hear about horrific stories, but they're usually secondhand. You don't usually sit with someone who's actually been through something. And you're sat, you know, while people are holding up pictures of their mums, of their dads, of their husbands, of their wives. And immediately when you're hearing these, you obviously put yourself in that position and think, how would I react? How would I feel if I'd been through this? And it's very, very difficult to listen to. And it makes you very, you know, a mix of angry, of sad, of, you know, I took my 15-year-old nephew on the filming with us. He did the third camera with us. And, you know, every night we shared a hotel room for the week when we were filming it. And every night we were just almost having a counseling session.
Yeah.
Of how on earth would you react if, you know, if that was you, and how would you deal with it? And,
Did he say, Jade? If we won't name him, obviously. What did the 15-year-old say? How did he react? How did it impact on him?
It just, you know, it just made him, you know, obviously he's always been very, you know, open to everything being in this family, but
yeah,
he was just very, very sad. And like, you know, I don't understand why this is happening. And it was because I think, you know, when you're that young, you haven't interacted with that many people. Therefore, you probably haven't seen really nasty people at first hand. You've probably heard about them. But, you know, seeing the effects of what these people are doing on people, you know, seeing grown women in their 70s, you know, men in their 50s crying on you, as we did that week, it's something that you're not built to deal with at that age, are you? And I think, you know, that's the kind of main emotion that yeah. we were discussing, is how sad it was and how unnecessary it was, and how, you know, profits over people is what's you know, prevailed again.
That's right. And worse. A Good Death, you can check it out on the Iconic platform, iconic.com, co-directed by Jamie and the journalist Jackie Devine, to sort of broke the story. And again, fantastic that she had the platform. She had the outlet to approach, like Iconic, that could you know provide her with the expertise, the producers, yourself directing, and it's brilliant. It's a brilliantly produced documentary. I don't say stuff like that lightly. The time is 24 minutes to the top of the hour. Jamie's going to stay with me for another 10 or so minutes. Jamie, when you got married, Isabel has been on. It was a lovely little montage of your wedding on Facebook. It looked absolutely beautiful. And I think you were talking about it. And you might have mentioned that Beth is a trained teacher, your good wife. She must be, Isabel is saying this on my website, she must have pretty strong opinions about what's happening to school children, the masking of them and the jab, you know, the pushing of jabs, or, you know, the obviously the government is looking now to jab 5 to 11-year-olds and even younger. And with Beth's teaching experience, she must have a lot to say about that.
Yeah, obviously she's absolutely disgusted, and she doesn't really have any interaction with any of the people she used to work with anymore, mainly because obviously we've not been vaccinated ourselves and our kids are not vaccinated at all, with any of the childhood ones or anything. And that, you know, that's not acceptable to some people. So yeah, that's one of the factors. And she was marginalized and pushed out of her friendship group, if you like. And I think, you know, that was quite tough for her to begin with. But I think, you know, we've all realized in the last couple of years that it sounds hippie, but your vibe attracts your tribe, kind of thing. And you might lose friends or people that you thought you were friends with, and you meet and make new ones that are more on your wavelength, and people you can be yourself around. You don't have to self-censor. But yeah, we were having this conversation last week, and she's been absolutely disgusted by the lack of teachers that are speaking out, the lack of teachers that are standing up and saying this isn't acceptable. But I think, again, I think, you know, there's certain things that have led to teachers not being what they used to be. You know, going into schools, it's not the same as it was. You know, Beth is very much a sort of old school teacher. You know, she's a loved Matilda and wanted to be Miss Honey, and that's what got her to want to be a teacher. You know, that really, you care for your children, you want them to do well, you want to look after them, you want to nurture them. Whereas to so many, it's just a job. And, you know, I think the fact that so few have spoken out is testament to that. Because if you cared about children, you wouldn't want to put them through that. And also, forget the compassion side of things. Just think about the basic learning. You're not going to learn when, imagine trying to learn French or Spanish or anything like that, or pronunciations, when you can't see someone's lips moving because they've got a mask on. That's not going to work. In the same way that, the windows are open in the middle of the winter, kids are having to wear coats and because they're freezing, because they've got this stupid rule on air circulation.
Yeah.
You don't do that if you care about children. And you do say no, and you wouldn't enforce it. Yet so many teachers, it seems, have and haven't stood up to that, which, I find incredibly worrying. And if I was teachers, I'd be probably watching my back, because I'd assume that after the NHS, they're probably next in line for one of these mandates, or they'd certainly be up there on the list. So yeah, she's obviously absolutely disgusted and very, very glad that she's not in that industry anymore. And like we've done with the media over the years, and with, people like yourself and my dad and Alex and people like that around the world, maybe we have to start something else that's better. And there's going to be teachers that are just scared to lose their jobs, that are on the right, that are thinking as we do. And, in the same way that there's tons of NHS staff doing the same, why not, rather than try and fix a broken system, why not start a new one? And I think you're definitely going to see more children wanting to be homeschooled. You're going to see more teachers probably looking to have a way out. And I know that the average lifespan of a teacher in terms of, their career, how long they spend in teaching, isn't anywhere near as long as you'd expect. I believe it's about 6 years.
No way, is that right?
Yeah, and that was before all of this. That was when Beth was still in the school. And because it's not what it was. It's you're vastly underpaid and overworked. And there's lots of, you're not given the tools that you need to be able to actually teach effectively and give kids the right kind of start in life. It's very much just ticking boxes. And I don't condone it, but I can probably see why a lot of them have probably just gone along with this and thought it's not worth the hassle. I'll just go along with it. Maybe that's a factor of why very few have spoken out.
You make a great point about the ticking boxes, about teaching becoming basically an exercise in target reaching.
It's completely that. Like, I remember the last year before Beth left teaching, she had, I think it was 31 kids, 5 special needs and 1 assistant, which is ridiculous, because some of the kids were, incredibly special needs and needed real help, like needed one-on-one help, really. And she had her target, obviously, to progress the kids. I think she was teaching year one, possibly, maybe reception. So young kids. And they have a target of how much they're meant to progress in that year. And every kid that effectively should have reached their target did. And every kid that was that shouldn't have reached their target, if you like, because they were started behind, progressed much further than they should have done. And she was told, you haven't succeeded because you've not hit the government guidelines. Despite the fact that there was no context that 5 of the kids in her class shouldn't have really progressed at all, and she progressed them massively. And it's like, what incentive then does she have next year?
Yeah, why would anybody keep going in that situation? Why would they not look somewhere else?
Yeah, exactly. And they're, like I say, they're massively overworked. They're only paid for the time they're actually in school. And, every Sunday night she'd be planning for the next week. Friday she'd be marking books. If you had the half term, the second week she'd be planning to go back. So this whole illusion of, I was probably one of them that thought teachers have a great life. They're off work all the time. Having then seen it firsthand, it's not like that at all. And you get no thanks for that. You get paid for, I think her payslip used to say 32 and a half hours a week. It was the school day and that was it.
And you've got to prepare lessons while you're at home. I mean, nobody else would put up with that. If I worked for a company, I love these stories, Jay, we're seeing in the media lately about people, about rules, about government. Governments are being asked to legislate to prevent companies sending emails to their employees out of hours. Now, I kind of like that, not because I'm lazy, but I'll work very hard for anybody who employs me. But when I'm at home, cuddled up on the sofa watching, I don't know, Ozark with my missus, I don't want to be getting text messages and emails from my company. I'm giving you 50 hours a week or 40, whatever it is. But people didn't know that about teaching. They didn't know that. And they wouldn't put up with it, but yet they expected teachers to put up with it.
Yeah, absolutely, they do. And I think it's wrong, completely wrong. I mean, I'm guilty of that all the time. I send messages to people late at night. I've had an idea. What do you think of this? But yeah, I totally agree. People should be, you know, doing the job that they've asked to do and shouldn't be going over and above. Otherwise, your work-life balance just becomes completely unhinged.
Yeah,
and that's
does.
What, you know, for a lot of teachers it is. It consumes them. It's their entire life.
And turns them off it. And by turning them off it, then ultimately, I mean, this obviously doesn't apply to Beth, obviously, but ultimately for many of them, it will eventually reduce their own interest in it. They won't be as invested in the children. It becomes a chore rather than, I shouldn't say vocation, because we shouldn't say vocation, but it becomes a chore rather than something that's, you know, immensely enjoyable. Because we've all fantasized about it. I watch Kindergarten Cop, you know, it's a silly thing to say this, but it's just a silly comedy movie, but it's so idyllic, it looks so amazing. Wouldn't it be lovely to work in a kindergarten with a load of crazy children? Yes, it would be if you were trusted and if you were allowed to, you know, use your own initiative and bring your own, I suppose, personality to it, but not when you're being followed around by people with pens and papers, evaluating you every time you go to the toilet and all that nonsense. It's dreadful stuff. I've got to ask this. If I'm talking out of line and you don't want to talk about this because it's personal, tell me to F off and I will. But you mentioned the children. And I know from speaking to Kerry years ago, your sister, her lovely children who are nearly grown up now, as you mentioned earlier, they didn't have any jabs either. I just wanted to ask you on that. Again, if I'm talking out of line, tell me to piss off. Is there any interference when you decide not to do that?
Well, no. I mean, I think a lot of parents are probably on the fence, and even those that don't choose to, possibly are kind of nervous in making that decision. Whereas, because I hadn't been vaccinated myself, I've never had a vaccine in my life, I was very confident that we're making the right decision. And I remember it was actually one of the third or fourth dates me and Beth had. I said, I want to have kids and they're not being vaccinated. That's a deal breaker.
Fantastic. So, date four. I love it, Jay. What a romantic you are. Fantastic.
Well, to be fair, she's 5 years older than me, so I didn't want her to think I was going to mess her around. When we met, I was 23. She was 28. So yeah. I thought, you know, she needs to know I'm not, you know, just not a normal 23-year-old that's looking for a laugh.
That's right. Yeah.
And I thought, you know, if that's a deal breaker, I want to know now. So then, you know, call it quits. But, you know, when we got up to, you know, the time that we were looking to have children, I gave her loads of literature and stuff to read and lots of videos to watch and lots of things to look at, so that when it came to the time, it was a joint decision. It wasn't just me saying this is what's happening and her going along with it. I needed her to come to the same conclusion, and she did by actually, you know, doing the research. With our first child, we got a bit of stick at the hospital for not having the flu and whooping cough, which you're meant to be given at 18 weeks pregnant. Baby's not even born at this point. And then we got a bit of stick at our son Travis was born for declining the vitamin K, which is the one that supposedly thickens their blood. Which, you know, there's lots of evidence that that's not actually good, because the reason that their blood is thin when they're born is that their head moves around and things come into place, and it helps. Hence why, you know, he was born with an absolute cone head, and by day five, it was normal.
Wow.
And
right.
things like that are allowed to happen because your blood's thinner. They obviously try and terrify you and tell you they're going to hemorrhage and bleed out, you know. But then when it came to the 8 weeks where they're meant to have some, obviously at that point I'm still not allowed to go in, and so I sent Beth with a letter which was quite blunt, but it basically was you know, at no point do we give you any permission, do you have any right to ask any questions related to this, this stance is not going to change, you have no right to vaccinate our son. And then they left us alone. And when we had our second, they've not even asked a question.
Because you marked the card with Travis. Isn't that fascinating now? And that, I'm glad you answered that, because there will be people listening to this, and there will be women listening to this, and they might be about to give birth, and they don't want to vaccinate their child either. but they're concerned about interference, you know, the health visitor turning up and knocking on the door. I mean, I've had a lawyer on the programme in the past giving advice to people in that instance, and the advice is quite simply be polite and say to the health visitor, everything is hunky-dory, thanks very much, but you won't be coming in. Thanks for your concern, kind of a thing. But thanks for answering that. So you took the firm, you took it in hand, sent a letter and said, listen, enough's enough now. And then they respected you and child number two, and they left you alone.
Yeah, I think that's the key. I think the key to remember is that, you know, most people, when you go to hospital, you don't go to hospital for a good reason. You don't see a doctor for a good reason. You know, giving birth is probably the only kind of anomaly to that rule. So you're normally nervous when you're around doctors. And I think there's also this sort of stigma that doctors are, because they've got a PhD and they've had 7 years at uni, they're better than you. They're more intelligent than you. People have the same things with lawyers and people like that. And you have to just, you know, I must admit, even in the hospital when we're given, when Travis was being born, it was quite ropey at the end, you know, forceps and so on, and they're really pressuring you with vitamin K, really. No, honestly, this could happen. Even I wavered for about 5 seconds.
They nearly convinced you, Jay. Wow.
You waver a bit and you think, no, I'm sure, I've done my research, we don't want to do this. But, you know, to somebody who's quite nervous, particularly through the pandemic, where so many people were giving birth on their own, or they were in masks and doctors were in masks, and you didn't have that dialogue and that relationship that you would normally build up with a midwife. Fathers weren't allowed to go to appointments. And, you know, I can see why so many people get backed into a corner and get made to feel like they're a bad parent. Like my wife was made to feel like she was a bad mother when she went for a scan with our second child, because she said no to the flu vaccine, and I wasn't allowed to go into the scan at all because I refused to wear a mask. And it's, you know, you've got all of these factors that you're already nervous. You're in a hospital, especially when you're going into a maternity ward. All you want is that baby to come out and be okay and be put in your arms, and you're having all these obstacles put in front of you and all this propaganda being spouted at you when you're holding something that's 8 weeks old. It's fragile, it's completely useless on its own. It needs you to nurture it, to look after it. I'm actually doing a bloody baby rocker while I'm saying this.
Are you? Get in there, Jay. That is a Stepford child right there that's not crying. Get in there.
You've got all these things going on, and you're expected to think rationally, think clearly, and it's, I think that's
stressful, Jay. That must have been stressful. You can't come in because you won't wear a mask, and Beth must have been stressed out. But you got through it, though. You held on to the courage of your convictions.
Yeah, we got through it, and you know, we left. And to be fair, what we did instead is Beth said to her, "Can you write down the gender in an envelope, please?" And then we opened that in the car together.
Fantastic! You couldn't wait, eh?
No,
it's been fabulous catching up with you, man, and shooting the breeze with you. Always interesting, Jay. Give a good sell to iconic.com. There are subscription, I suppose, packages is the best way to put it, that suit everybody there, really. I think for what you get, I think it's terrific value. Iconic.com, iconic.com. You've got loads planned for it, Jay.
Yes, absolutely. The ambition is to be you know, the biggest independent media platform in the world. You know, we've got subscribers all over the world. We're launching a studio in Austin, Texas in the summer to add an American arm. We've got an amazing duo over there that are going to take care of that for us. Hopefully I'll be able to actually go at some point. We've got some amazing content coming out this year. We've got a really big film we're working on at the moment that's going to come out in June. We've just launched a new show which you appeared on last week, the first female-led alternative media show, I believe, in the world, certainly in the UK. And then we've got about three more flagship shows to launch this year, which are going to be, you know, with new episodes every week. Tons of live events coming up through the summer, so there's lots going on, and you know, we've got all the various applications that the big lot have, you know. Fire Stick, Roku, Android, iOS, Chromecast, all of those things that are, some are out and some are being worked on at the moment.
Fantastic. I had an email from somebody I've known for several years, and he or she has worked at a major broadcaster for years, and he or she told me that he or she will be doing some work with you, and I was delighted to hear that.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
I should know who that is, shouldn't I?
I'll send you a message later on. But it's lovely. Again, somebody who's absolutely pissed off of the handcuffs of working for a major broadcaster and sick to death of not being able to challenge what's going on is saying, well, I'll take my considerable skills and I'll go and jump on the good ship iconic.com. I think it's absolutely brilliant, mate. It really is.
Thanks. Well, thanks for your support. And thanks for coming on and giving us a plug and stuff, as you do, you know.
Not at all, will you? If it wasn't any good, I wouldn't. And you know what I mean, that, and I know you'd be the same if it wasn't any good. I wouldn't know. My opinion, my word is too important to me to be, you know, recommending something I don't like or just for the sake of it. No, it's outstanding. I reckon, folks, go to iconic.com, check it out. Listening to this now, you may already be subscribed to it. If not, get on over there, have a look at it. Thanks, Jay. I hope we'll catch up again fairly soon, mate. Congratulations to you and everybody at Iconic for all your success, and to you and to Beth and the children as well. Onwards and upwards, pal. Godspeed to you. Thanks for coming on today.
Thanks, Richie. Take care of yourself, mate.
All the best for now. Jamie Ike, folks, iconic.com. Lovely to catch up with Jamie again. The time is around about 6 minutes to the top of the hour. Loads of comments came in during that. Thank you for them, about vitamins and children. Angela said she declined vitamin K for her children. She stood firm on that. When I hear vitamin K, I'm an idiot, me. Isn't K potassium on the periodic table, isn't it? Vitamin K is not potassium, is it? Is it? I'm a real idiot when it comes to stuff like that. But I'm glad I asked him that question, because, to be honest with you, if you listen to this long enough, you'll know that my much better half and myself, that we don't have any children. I think both of us would like to. I'd like it to happen. I think El Frogo would like it to happen. But we've often talked about that eventuality, because we would homeschool. I would do the teaching, it's been determined. Not because I'm any brighter than herself. No, I'm not. But with the qualifications I have, the English qualification and stuff, I would probably do it. She would do the mathematics, obviously, as the accountant. But we've talked about what interference might there be once you say very firmly from the word go, no, the child will not be jabbed with anything, thank you. What sort of interference? And I've had a theory over the years. I've had a theory. And my theory is that, now, I'm not classist. I am a working class kid from Ballybeg in Waterford City, and I am proud of it. I am absolutely proud of my roots. I'm working class. I think the health visitors and the social workers, they go picking on people that are not educated and that are fairly poor when they start talking to people about, you know, vaccines and maybe you're not a good parent and all that sort of stuff. But I think when you're somewhat educated, being educated doesn't mean intelligent, of course. It doesn't mean you're any more intelligent than anybody else. But when you're a bit more sophisticated, you're used to dealing with people, you're used to standing up for yourself, I think they tend to leave people like that alone. There's no joy in it. And I think they pick off families, you know, in areas. You've heard what I said. You know what I mean. You can, again, we're going to do a phone-in, I think, on Wednesday. I'm not sure. I'll let you know online tomorrow. You can pick up these issues with me on the phone-in. Thank you so much to Anna de Buisseret. Thanks, Anna, for coming on again. That was a terrific chat. And to my old friend, Jamie Ike, iconic.com. Thanks to them, and thanks to you for listening. Back with you again tomorrow at 5 o'clock UK time. The Richie Allen Show is archived on podomatic.com. That's the place to get it. It will appear on Podbean, on iTunes, on Spotify, but increasingly it tends to be cut there into little segments, or it's cut by half because we might talk about vaccines or vaccine injuries. The place where it will not be cut is podomatic.com. That is where I upload it. That is who I pay to host the show, richieallen.podomatic.com. Thanks, Jamie. Thanks, Anna. Thank you for listening. Back with you again tomorrow. Take care of yourselves and one another. And enjoy the rest of your Monday. Bye now.